Everyone knows this music. Even if you don't know its name.
I think the Gymnopédie is one of the most played, most heard, most used piece of music maybe ever.
I think it's this sort of hidden gem that people really respond to.
Gymnopédie No. 1 is the best-known work of composer Erik Satie. I'm Robin Washington. In this special edition of Hear Me Out, we'll celebrate the 153rd anniversary of the French composer's birth. Yes, I said 153rd. It's a little odd, but so was he. We'll also hear excerpts of a concert in Paris honoring his 150th birthday 3 years ago, and talk to a Wisconsin man who's brought Satie to life in a one-man show. All that and more after this. Welcome to this special edition of Hear Me Out. I'm Robin Washington. Gymnopédie No. 1 is one of the most recognizable pieces of music ever written, but outside the music world, its composer remains an obscure iconoclast. He may have worked for that reputation, carrying himself as the eccentric velvet gentleman in bawdy cabarets. Yet Erik Satie was one of the most influential composers of the 20th century, with artists from Philip Glass to Blood, Sweat, and Tears paying homage to his piano works, ranging from the melancholy to the absurd. Today is the 153rd anniversary of his birth, and portions of this program were intended for broadcast on the 150th 3 years ago. We had a series of technical difficulties then. Perhaps that's the way fate would have it for Satie. But this anniversary is as good as any to continue the celebration. Erik Satie was born in Honfleur, Normandy, to a French father and Scottish mother. He entered the Paris Conservatory and was immediately deemed untalented. In the late 1880s, he found his way to the Paris Café Society, where he introduced himself as a gymnopédiste, an obscure word possibly referring to naked dances in ancient Greece. Satie made a living as a cabaret pianist, but most of his life found him short on cash, even if he dressed impeccably every day for decades in a wardrobe of dark gray suits. The love of Satie's life was Susan Valadon. She left him after only 6 months, leaving Satie heartbroken. He collaborated with artists and writers including Pablo Picasso and Jean Cocteau. He also socialized and argued with fellow composers like Maurice Ravel and Claude Debussy. Satie was most influential for inspiring Les Sixes, a group of younger composers rebelling against both the orchestrations of Richard Wagner and the impressionistic style of Ravel and Debussy. Satie died of cirrhosis of the liver in 1925. The man in the fine gray suits was found to have been living in a tiny apartment with two grand pianos, one on top of the other, filled with letters and compositions thought to have been lost. Here is an excerpt of one of those, the Nacien No. 5. Thank you. The Nazi in No. 5, performed by David Kadouche on March 15th at the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. The concert was part of a series at the museum celebrating the 150th anniversary of the birth of Erik Satie. Born in Nice, France in 1985, David Kadouche is becoming one of the most acclaimed pianists of his generation. He studied at the Nice Conservatory and at age 14 entered the Paris Conservatory, doing much better than Erik Satie a century before. He's performed under the baton of conductors Leonard Slatkin, Charles Dutoit, and Daniel Barenboim, and played with violinist Yitzhak Perlman at Carnegie Hall. I caught up with him in Duluth, Minnesota, a day after his appearance with the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra, playing Ravel and Debussy. We began our conversation with my suggestion that Je ne peux dire might just be the gateway to classical music for those just learning to appreciate it. Here's David Kadouche.
I think you're absolutely right. Last time I was on YouTube, I saw the number of views of the gymnopédie is just impressive. People go and listen to that gymnopédie as a kind of a retreat. I think in this music, in Satie's music, there's a melancholia. There's this sense of contemplation all the time and being sad in a big city of like Paris or... There's something very relatable in his music. It just makes a very big first impression. I think the Gymnopédie is one of the... most played, most heard, most used piece of music maybe ever.
Do you think it's overused?
I don't think there's such a thing as overusing a piece. It's quite beautiful to know that a piece of music evokes so many things because it's used in so many different kind of settings, right? I think it's a testimony to how evocative this music is, how you can project anything on it. It's really powerful.
So if Je ne peux dire, or the three Je ne peux dire, are the gateway, then where does Satie take us?
Well, his music takes us to repetitive music, I would say, to Philippe Glass, to all those people. I see it that way. He's actually more important in the 20th century than we think he is. We see him as a personage almost, you know, a character inside of the street of Paris with his hat and his beard and his personality. But I think what he left to the musical world is more than that. I think many composers got inspired from his humor, his sense of melody, and also the harmonies that he used that is very Satie-like. You can't find in almost any other composer. He has lots of humor. It's not just sadness, Satie. He has this way of trying to surprise the listener. And also in many pieces of his, you have this engine behind. He's fascinated by engines, by machines, by little noises that machines make. I play this boat on the ocean where you feel the boat moving and you feel the engine of the boat on the waves. Then you have big booms of explosions. It's quite fascinating what he makes with only a piano. And that's going to be used throughout the entire century. So I think he's more important than what we think.
Did he maybe miss his calling by being so simple but scaled down and being just piano? I mean, there was a whole case of Debussy telling him, listen, you've got to orchestrate this stuff.
I think in his case, it's difficult to guess what would have happened if he did otherwise, right? But his way of using the piano is so modest and the melodies are so simple that I think translating that into the orchestra wouldn't have worked somehow. I think what is touching in his music is this kind of fragile, that everything could break at one moment and that everything is not lasting. And that's what's beautiful. So I think he's maybe looked upon a little bit as a light composer, but he still played. He's still so popular so many years after his death. I don't think he missed his calling. I think it's exactly what was his personality like. The piano was for him his way of expressing himself.
The other way he expressed himself was with his titles. My favorite is play. That actually goes well. That's my phone going off there with the message. But I was about to say one of his titles is play like a nightingale with a toothache.
Right.
How do you do that?
Well, you know, those titles are somehow, they're very difficult to understand. I see it more as a message from the composer so many years after his death. He's winking at us, and it's his way of also kind of playing with loneliness. When he's saying all those weird titles or indications, I don't say we shouldn't do them. We will do with them, but it's more of a message in the bottle for the interpreter.
Well, even if you didn't do it, how would anyone know you didn't play it like a nightingale with a toothache?
Right. It's really your guess. I don't know how you would know. Yeah.
What about his life? How much of that? He was interesting. He was very interesting. He was very lonely. He fell in love with a woman and what he saw her for 5 minutes or something, and he got smitten for the rest of his life. How reflective was his life and his music?
I think the loneliness might be a theme that is always present, no? Paris is always present in his music. You can feel the streets of Paris. You can see the cabaret. So he must have heard songs from, you know, the café. So that's always present, his connection with the popular world. It's not just classical music. So he's influenced by that. And then his... I am not a specialist of Satie's life. I didn't study his life. I just know that maybe his sexual identity was not so clear. His love for that woman was a little bit also, you know, it's the time where symbolism is very powerful, where the symbolism of what happens in your life is very present. So it's a life full of meaning. And that's also, it comes back to the indications that he put. Everything has meaning, but in a very poetic way. So he tries to find ways of living his life in a very poetic way all the time. And that's very inspiring.
One other part of his life that I'm wondering and is reflective in his music is, in a way, a facade that he had. So he was the velvet gentleman. He always dressed impeccably and everything. Right. On the other hand, he was dirt poor. You went into his apartment and it was like, ugh. Again, is that reflective of his many sides of his music?
I don't know. It's also something we build around his personality. I guess he was poor, but you know, he was a composer. I don't know if as a composer at that time you would earn your living as you know so well. And it's also part of La Bohème, no? That was so present at that time, where you didn't have to live like a king to be a king. You only needed art and you know, water and love. I guess that's what they were feeding them from. So. The legend that is surrounding Satie's personality is actually helping his music, I think, also a lot. There's this aura of, yes, someone poor, someone that goes into those, you know, in Paris we have those chambres de bonne, we call them. It's up in the garrets. I can picture him in those kind of very small apartments trying to compose. Yeah, but it's helping his music, I think.
Maybe I'm doing a projection. Well, he had the impeccable suits. On the other hand, he had nothing in his pocket. It probably doesn't matter, right?
It doesn't matter, but it's part of the music. When you hear his music, you actually picture him. I think it's part of the whole experience of Satie. It's like Shostakovich without knowing about Shostakovich being in the USSR and being oppressed and trying to do his music in a way that would not angry the government. You know, there's this whole legend around those composers, and Satie and Shostakovich are pretty good examples that make their music so much more powerful. Without those stories, without that settings, you would listen to their music maybe in a completely different way.
Actually, every time I hear the second piano concerto of Shostakovich, that's exactly what I think, because I think the whole reason he put snare drums in the thing was to make Stalin happy. Snare drums are military, and the second movement has nothing to... The second movement is almost like Satie.
Of course, yeah, it's actually pretty close. I absolutely love the second movement. That That's what I'm talking about. Those legends are absolutely necessary to your understanding of the piece. I don't know if they make your understanding right, but it's more moving, and music is really about that at the end. Yeah.
What would be your 5 favorite Satie pieces?
Gymnopédie, of course, everybody knows. I think the Gnossienne, the first one, is really something that should be heard, because it's the wandering there, of letting yourself go, of trying to improvise this music. It's just marvelous. It's even when you play it, it's just about being surprised of what's going to happen. Songs, Tendrement, Poudre d'Or, Je te veux, is just so charming. All those walls that I'm thinking about recording them, because you can feel the time there. It's just amazing. You can see the people dancing, you can see the cabaret, you can see just a time of an epoch. And when you hear that and when you play that, it's traveling through time.
So we're at 150 for Satie. 50 more years, what will Satie's legacy be?
I can't. It's not my position to say. I think his music will live because it's very easy to listen to him. I'm not saying that as it's easy music, it's easy listening music. It's not just that. I think it's, as you said, it's a perfect way to enter in the classical world, because it has elements of every world. It's those melodies. They could be pop melodies of a song. So you get that, and you also get the piano experience. So I think it will just live on. Yes, I hope so. Of course, it deserves that.
Pianist David Kadouche with music from his March 15, 2016 concert at the Musée d'Orsay in Paris for the 150th anniversary of Erik Satie's birth. And our conversation in Duluth a month later, following his performance with the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra. This is Hear Me Out. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to this special edition of Hear Me Out on the Life and Music of Erik Satie. I'm Robin Washington. Up next, a discussion with members of the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra, but first, a personal note. I have been a fan of Erik Satie for more than 40 years. I was hoping to mark the 150th in some way when I heard about the Musée d'Orsay concerts in 2016 performed by renowned interpreters of his work.
Un dernier pour la route.
I absolutely wanted to go, but could not. The best I could do to hear French composers that spring was a Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra concert of Ravel's Concerto in G. The young soloist was from France and quite good. When he played an encore of Clair de Lune, I said, wait a minute, he's got to have Satie in his repertoire. The next morning I looked him up, and David Kadouche, he had been one of the soloists in Paris at the Musée d'Orsay. I called the DSSO executive director immediately, and yes, Mr. Kadouche would be delighted to talk about Satie at his hotel just hours before his flight back to France. A few minutes later, we were discussing Gymnopédie. For that, thanks go to Dirk Meyer, music director of the DSSO, who brought Kadouche to town. He joins me now with concertmaster Aaron Aldridge. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So what goes into selection? We're pretty much here, actually, because you selected a concert that had Maurice Ravel's Concerto in G, which brought David Kadouche from France, and the rest is something like history. Mm-hmm. What went behind all that?
Oh, there's so many different things that go into the selection of repertoire. You know, it has to do with the overall season, of course. It has to do with how long ago have you played a certain piece? Can you repeat it already? You know, and so the piece that brought David here was, of course, the Ravel Piano Concerto in G, and that was a piece that the orchestra had not played in many, many years, decades, I think, even.
And how do you pick the person? How do you get the particular soloist?
You either hear somebody in concert or somebody is recommended and then you kind of research them. And with David, I met him through our agent, actually. We have the same management. And so I researched him and I listened to a lot of his stuff. And I thought that he really had something very special. And particularly, I thought that he is fantastic at the French repertoire. So when the Ravel Piano Concerto came up and I decided, okay, well, you know, I think the DSSO should be doing this, you know, I thought, well, you know, we should really try to get him here to do this.
Aaron, what kind of pressure is there on the rest of the orchestra when you have a soloist in a piece like that that really is dominated? I mean, the second movement is almost half of it is, you know, it's like a recital for piano.
It's a lot of pressure, actually, because first of all, you just have the integrity of wanting to be good for the soloist. It's tricky because there's lots of entrances that are unexpected. These are a little bit off kilter, and Dirk does a great job of cueing us, showing us when to come in, but it's scary. And especially when you have the performance that we had from David, which was really so special, it just amps that up even more because you know that his performance is going to be great, so you want to be equal to that.
What is special about the Ravel Concerto in G?
It's hard. It's a very difficult piece. It doesn't sound like it, but it really is a tricky piece. And I was talking to David about this too, and you know, we both agreed that it's as fun a piece as it is, as tricky and difficult it is to perform. There's so many little things that need to be exactly in the right place, otherwise it doesn't work. And then there's, of course, this whole jazz influence that also really presents its very own challenges. So it's a very difficult piece to perform.
It sounds like it's improvisation, but it's written down.
And so. Exactly, and that is precisely the kind of aspect that makes it hard.
That would be a parallel, too, of Satie, I think, particularly, again, if you take the piano parts only, that, yes, they sound improvised, but they're very structured.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's the case with a lot of more modern music, definitely a lot of 20th century music, where at first listen, it might sound even chaotic. But if you would hear it performed not correctly, it would not be the same experience. Absolutely not. There is a structure to the chaos, if you want.
Great. Well, David Kadusha's Ravel was very well received, and he did an immediate encore, and he did
Clair de Lune, of course, by Debussy.
So I have to tell you, my reaction as a member of the audience and someone who's been a Satie fan for more than 40 years, Ravel and Debussy were both French. It was not an accident that you had David Kadusha here.
No, of course not. You know, French guy, French music, you know, and he is somewhat of an expert for that kind of repertoire, so it made total sense.
Right. So this guy, I realized, playing Ravel, Debussy, he's got to have Satie in his repertoire. So not quite as soon as I got home, but the next morning I looked up his name, and to my shock and surprise, he turns out to be one of the people who was doing the official Satie commemoration in Paris at the Musée d'Orsay. Are these things meant to happen?
Obviously they are, yes.
And the other credit goes very much so to Rebecca Peterson, your executive director, who, I mean, as soon as I found that out, I said, is he still in town? Is he still in Duluth? She tracked him down, and he was just a gracious interview. And then he was going directly to France, too, so it wasn't that he was staying around.
No. He was here just to play the Ravel with us.
The obvious question on Jean de Petit, I mean, it's like the most popular piece of music in the world, maybe, or something. You could argue with me.
One of them, yeah.
One of them, yeah. everybody knows it, but they don't necessarily know that they know it, or they don't know what that is, you know.
That's true.
When did you first hear it? Can you recall?
Yes, I was playing the piano somewhere in my teenager years, and I had a book that was called The Greatest Piano Pieces or something like this. It was a red linen-bound, cloth-bound book, and it was part of that. And I played through that entire book. And so the first time that I heard it was, you know, playing it. And I really liked it. So I kind of found a couple of recordings of it. And yeah, that was the first time I came across it.
That is interesting because it's the first time I've ever heard anyone say the first time I heard it was when I played it. Usually you hear something and then that sort of imprints you and you, right.
Sure, absolutely. That was just totally by accident, really. At this time, I'm probably like 12 or so.
Aaron?
I think I heard it so much. I think it wasn't until I was in music history that I knew what it was. Because, you know, you hear it so much and all along that I think I didn't understand what it was until I was actually doing a degree. I think Satie was, for me, really trying to simplify beauty. So I think it's this sort of hidden gem that people really respond to.
Having gone to that length to get some Satie, can we have some Satie sometime this year, please?
There's so little for the orchestra.
One of those orchestrations or something like that? Or
I'll look into it.
All right. We've been talking to Dirk Meyer, the music director of the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra, and concertmaster Aaron Aldridge. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks so much.
That conversation with Dirk Meyer and Aaron Aldridge, who's also a music professor at the University of Wisconsin-Superior, took place shortly before May 17, 2016. What I didn't know then was another Satie commemoration was about to take place right here in Wisconsin. Composer and actor James Valk is the co-artistic director of the Third Avenue Playhouse in Sturgeon Bay, just north of Green Bay. Also a fan of Satie, he marked the 150th of celebration that year, writing and performing in a one-man show entitled Velvet Gentleman. The work is composed entirely of Satie's writings, which were as prolific and as provocative as his music. The show has already had a revival last winter, and I caught up with James just last week. Thank you for doing this.
My pleasure.
So, when did you first hear Je ne Pedis?
I think I was probably 11 years old, taking piano lessons at the conservatory in Milwaukee on the east side, and heard a fellow student play it. And I think, like everybody who ever hears it, just thought it was one of the most ineffably beautiful melodies I'd ever heard. Of course, I couldn't have expressed it that way at that time, but I fell in love with it and knew that I had to play it and play more Satie besides that, which I eventually did.
So going up from there, when did you first delve into his life and figure out who he was?
I think in my early 20s, I became aware of the pieces Sport et Divertissement, Sports and Diversions, which was a collection of a couple dozen piano pieces that had text, sort of Dada-esque poetry written in the music, you know, within the staff lines of the music. And the music itself, the notes, were written, handwritten by him. I became familiar with it through one of those Dover reproductions. So it was actually his manuscript of it. And the music itself seemed to be art, visual art. And then to make it even more visual, there were paintings, watercolor paintings by Charles Martin that went with each of these very brief little pieces. And it struck me as sort of a miniature Gesamtkunstwerk, you know, Wagner's term for a total and complete work of art that engages all of the senses and uses all of the arts. And here it wasn't, you know, a five-hour-long opera. It was a collection of tiny miniature piano pieces, some of which are barely 30 seconds long, but each of which seemed to tell a complete story and had music, text, and visuals. So that struck me as theatrical. And a couple of years ago, We had a slot open at Third Avenue Playhouse, where I'm the co-artistic director, and I occasionally appear in a show at TAP, usually in a small supporting role or some such, but I was kind of obsessed with this Satie idea and playing these pieces. And I knew I wouldn't do it as a recital. I'm really not that kind of pianist. I'm pretty good, but I wouldn't go see me in a recital, so I don't know why I would think anybody else would. But still wanted to somehow bring these pieces to life in some way. So that's when I really started delving into Satie's life and finding out what was the twisted, bizarre, and wonderful mind that thought of that poetry and these pieces. And the more I read about him and found out about him, so I decided at a certain point that to fill that slot in our theater season, that I would do a one-man show where I would play Erik Satie.
And even though you had a slot to fill, was it an easy sell? Because, again, he is an unusual character, and you're indoctrinated and I'm indoctrinated with him, but telling somebody cold is a little bit hard to do.
Yes, you're right. But we have a rather unusual situation at our theater. Even though we're in a fairly small town, our audience really comes to see anything that we do. We're so lucky and fortunate to have adventurous audiences, curious audiences, and really smart audiences. So I was shocked at how many Satie fans there were that came out of the woodwork. And I was delighted, too, to find that we were creating new Satie fans. And people were just fascinated with his music, his life, and I'm trailing off. You can edit that part out.
No, I like that part. Satie fans coming out of the woodwork is great. That's interesting. Are there any Satie clubs in Wisconsin that you know about, or do we all keep to ourselves?
I think we keep to ourselves. I think we're an odd bunch.
Fitting an homage to our patron saint there, who very much kept to himself.
He did.
What of his writings and extra musical or other endeavors, what stands out to you? What's a Satie story that you think everybody should know?
You want me to go into something from the show? One of them is about him. Yes, here is something that everybody should know about him, something that he said about himself. This is Erik's voice. Many people will tell you that I am not a musician. They are correct. From the beginning of my career, I immediately classified myself as a phonometrographer. My work is pure phonometrics. If you look at my genuine flabby preludes for a dog, my reverie on a dish, my three elegant waltzes by a squeamish fop, you can see that musical ideas played no part in their creation. Scientific thought is predominant. Besides, I enjoy measuring a sound much more than hearing one. The first time I used a phonoscope, I examined a medium-sized B-flat. I can assure you I have never seen anything more revolting. It came out of a fat tenor, whom I also weighed. In any case, with a motodynamophone, a phonometrist of quite mediocre capabilities can take down more sounds than the most expert musician, given the same amount of time and effort. It is thanks to this that I have written so much.
That's great. And I've actually read that one. So, where do you go from here? It was successful. You had a longer engagement than anticipated.
Well, it was actually quite a hit. We were shocked. exactly. Satie's a hit. I was originally doing it in one act, and a few days before we opened, we decided to put in an intermission, just in case people didn't like it and wanted to leave, so they wouldn't have to get up in the middle of it and walk out or sit there, you know, watching something they didn't like. Well, we had very few walkouts, and, you know, it happens in any theatrical performance. There's walkouts all the time, but the walkout factor was very low, and it did quite well for us at the theater. So we did run it again, sort of by popular demand, because many people wanted to see it again, and there were those who, Satie fans, who didn't come out of the woodwork the first time, who were sorry they missed it and wanted to see it. So we did do a little extra run this past Christmas.
Any chance of bringing it to Duluth Superior?
Sure, get me a booking.
When I played my Jean Le Petit at Le Chat Noir, I became known as Esoteric Satie. And the consensus was that they had been composed by a savage with good taste.
It's not something where I just throw my costume in a suitcase and come and do it. It was actually quite an elaborate presentation with about 300 projections, either of his musical manuscripts or his sketches or artwork of the time by people that he knew. You know, he moved in quite rarefied circles. He was friends with Debussy and Ravel and Cocteau and...
Right.
Picasso,
well, and that's everybody. The other thing is, of course, he had the ballets Parade and Berlac, which don't get a lot of play because they were meant to be pretty out there, and they are out there, and pretty hard to put on.
They are out there. They're still out there. I think he still is outside of the norm of anything that we consider music or poetry or art. He still is sort of avant-garde.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like your performance actually makes him a bit more accessible than he would himself.
Perhaps.
Maybe.
Perhaps.
Depending how well you're...
Perhaps. Ask some of the people who walked out. But it was so freeing to play him. I'd never played a character quite like that. And I love playing musicians because I am one. And I think I kind of... can bring that to it, and I get it on a level that other actors might not, but because he said and did anything, and I believe early in his life, he couldn't help it. It just was his way, and I think as his life went on, he did it on purpose. It was sort of it was his way of getting through life.
Right. I see that you played the accordion at one point in the performance.
I did. I actually played the Jean Le Petit on the accordion because I thought that everybody had heard it played on the piano and I wanted to do it a little bit differently. You know, and we've heard it played on soprano sax and flute and clarinet and violin, certainly. And all these things have been done. And I never found or heard of anybody playing it on the accordion. I'm sure they have, but... I couldn't find any evidence of it.
Well, you know, we have the accordion museum in Superior, a world of accordion. I'm not kidding. It is the accordion museum. We just did a show about it, and they just had an international gathering. So, takeaway, he remains, no matter what you do and I do and people who've done various productions, and I still go out and I say Eric Satie to people, and they go, who? Is that his fate, or is that just part and parcel of who he was? He has probably one of the most recognizable pieces of music ever, and yet people still don't know his name.
Well, I think that was part of his appeal to me, and I guess that is what I would like my show, Velvet Gentleman, to have imparted to people, that it doesn't matter to me, James, if I'm a household name or not. What matters to me is the work. And I'd like to think that that was true of Satie as well, that, yes, he was notorious in his own lifetime and was certainly known in certain circles and was either not known or really sort of shunned or ridiculed in other circles, but that didn't matter to him. He was extremely prolific and must have written multiple pieces every day of his life. And I think for him, it was ultimately all about the work and not about his legacy. But he does have a wonderful legacy because he has this beautiful melody that we all know and all love.
Well, I don't think there's too much more we need to add to that. So thank you so much for sharing that and sharing your work.
All right.
That was composer and actor James Valk of the Third Avenue Playhouse in Sturgeon Bay discussing his one-man play, Velvet Gentleman. Along with monologues comprised of the words of Eric Satie and multimedia visual projections, the performance includes music, including Je ne peux pas, played on the accordion. This is Hear Me Out. Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Robin Washington. So now do you know Eric Satie? Maybe enough to bring up at a cocktail party or French cabaret? For the rest of his story, we'll let his music speak for him with selections from David Kadouch's concert at the Musée d'Orsay. They are Petite Ouverture à Danseur, Nacien No. 7, and Les Piccadilly.
Thank you.
That's it for this special edition of Hear Me Out. Our program was written and produced by me and co-produced by John Munson, with additional production help from Danielle Kading and Julia Chang. Tim Davis was our production assistant, and John Talcott provided technical help. The co-executive producers are Paul Danberg and myself, Robin Washington. Special thanks are due to all our guests, and in particular David Kadush, for making available his concert from the Musée d'Orsay. I'm Robin Washington. Hear Me Out is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio.